Down to Business with Bobby Kerr on News Talk.
Sponsored by Bank of Ireland.
So, our business review panel are here in the shape of Joan Mulville. She's an artist and a digitalisation expert. And also by Stephen O'Leary, the founder of Alitico. Good morning, one and all.
Morning, Bobby.
Morning, Bobby.
Now, I know I've worked this on Saturday for the last 17 years, in fact, even probably longer than that. But just one in seven public-only consultants are prepared to work the new rostered Saturday shift, Stephen. What is it about Saturdays that people don't like working?
Yeah, and again, this is one of the, we talk about this very often, Bobby, you need to be careful of the headline versus the reality when it comes to here, because doctors most certainly are working Saturdays and Sundays, and consultants, in fact, are working Saturdays and Sundays. This is to do with the new contracts that were set up and the aim of that contract being more flexible working, right? So these changes were made because the HSE and the government wanted there to be a greater level of flexibility, right? This idea that it didn't make sense to condense all of this consultant work into 5 days when seven were available.
Which at a high level seems logical.
Very logical, right? Yeah. And very sensible. And if you've got something like a hospital that's available 7 days, why not use it all 7 days? The problem here isn't the doctors or their availability. It is so much bigger than that. Now, that's the headline and that's the story of the piece and the focus here. But there's obviously a counter argument, and the counter argument is that a doctor or a consultant on their own does not go in and fix things for a patient. This is
so that while the doctors may be there, they don't have the support services that are needed to provide the said service.
Absolutely.
On the Saturday.
And the IMO are quoted in this piece, and they make the point really, really well that you're talking about nurses, diagnostics, radiology, labs, pharmacy, admin, and then the very basic thing of hospital beds.
Porters. Right?
You know, yeah. You need so many different moving parts here. And while the focus, obviously, around consultants very often comes up because of the size of salaries or the cost or, you know, private care, all these other things that we very often see, it's a much more complex story. And I think what's very interesting, and in a way it's a shame it's almost buried at the end here, is that staffing levels, not just of those support staff, but of the consultants themselves, are also at the core here. They talk about the fact that Ireland needs 110 consultants per 100,000 people. And currently we have 87.6 per 100,000 people.
Okay. Joan, just a couple of things. One in seven hospital consultants who have signed up to new public-only contracts are working rostered Saturday shifts. And then only one in three agreeing to work extended day evening shifts, despite a key aim of the contract being introduced more flexible work. So do they have the option of, like, is it a choice? Are you not either working it or you're not working it?
Well, I think the thing is that you're working it, but there's a question about whether or not, while the senior doctors are fulfilling the 37-hour week, they're largely delivered Monday to Friday.
Yeah.
So they can only work a certain number of hours under working time directives. So if they're working the weekends and they have to take a day off maybe during the week, which is also flagged in the article. The other thing that struck me, and I fully agree with everything that Stephen was saying, but there is the other part that says separate figures show that the HSE has high absenteeism rates, with around 7,600 staff out on average in a day. Now, absenteeism is a big question mark. Like, that could genuinely be sick leave, in which case, you know, obviously you're working in a hospital, you might be more susceptible to picking up.
But I have to say, Joan, that figure of 7,600 out absent every day, it jumped off the page.
It does. And it says high, but it doesn't say high relative to, like, I don't know what a normal industry average is or as a percentage of staff. It is.
Well, the HSE rate of absenteeism is 6%.
Yeah.
The figures, that's 7,600 staff absentee, approximately 2,418 more than the target.
Like, if you in an organization had an overall average 6% staff gap that you had to fill, that's a lot to be doing on a variable basis.
Well, it's six people out of 100 not showing up every day.
Okay, but let's look at the correlation here, right? So let's take what we talked about at the start. Right? You need 110 consultants per 100,000 people. We've got 87.6. We're not just short consultants.
Yeah.
Nurses will tell you consistently that there are not enough nurses. And what happens is, when you don't have enough people to do the basic jobs in an organization, people burn out.
Yeah.
So I totally get that. And then the system starts to, it is a perfect example of those wicked problem solvings. It's a huge, big systemic thing, and there is not one solution. And what happens is we tend to look at these things going, well, we'll get these contracts in place for consultants, and that'll be the start of solving that problem. But it just, all it does is highlights the knock-on effect of that and the requirements elsewhere in the system.
I agree with your analysis, Stephen. Absolutely on the money. Other presidents turn to prayer or the bottle, but Trump is turning to construction. So this is fiddling while Rome burns, Stephen, in terms of US debt just hitting $40 trillion for the first time, sent the yield of 30-year United States bonds to their highest level since 2007. That was earlier in the week. So Trump's way of dealing with this is basically to build ballrooms in the White House.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's a challenge to find lightness in a story so serious, but it's the talent of Keith Duggan writing in the Irish Times today, and a reminder by a newspaper. His America Letter is another really excellent piece. And it's a story with essentially two halves to it, right? It begins with, like you say, the absolute seriousness and the unfathomable size, ultimately, of the US debt. Now, I mean, $40 trillion isn't a number that anyone can really make any normal sense of unless you work in that space.
Or you're Elon Musk.
Yeah, right. I mean, exactly. It's all about your point of reference. But what Duggan does is he basically juxtaposes that piece where, Trump is almost pretending that's not there or ignoring the problem. And I think one of the lines we saw was that that piece about a Band-Aid on a bullet hole in terms of the steps that are being taken, with his continued and absolute fascination with construction. And so the second half of this piece is all about kind of the ad-libbed 30-minute impromptu tell the press how I'm building something in the White House at the moment. And like the level of detail he goes into. But one of the really interesting things that Duggan picks up on is Trump's passion for that and his change in tone when he talks about construction. You know, he mentions this kind of almost lightness, this positivity that is completely lacking in any other form of communication that Trump has.
Yeah.
And it's because it's his comfort zone. It's what he knows.
He said, Joan, he'd many others, this is on the tour of the White House, about the beauty of the tapered flagpoles. I'm very good at flagpoles, he explained, about the possibility of using the helipad as an outdoor cocktail area before guests could walk to the ballroom on the flawless granite.
Yeah, I was impressed that he was replacing boring old asphalt for flawless granite. And I did wonder, could he keep it as white as he had kept the reflection pool blue? I don't know that he'd have as much success there. I liked the part at the very, very start, where he likened that. So there's this big installation in a number of places around Washington where you can see the national debt. So if you're stuck in traffic and you're a regular tax-paying American and you are stuck in traffic, you are getting that flashed in front of you every day when you're freezing cold or you're sweltering in the heat because of climate change, and you're watching your national debt growing and growing side by side by a man who is building a ballroom that is increasing that national debt. So even if you can get past the war, and ideologically, whether or not you agree or don't agree as an American taxpayer with that, it's the idea that he's spending your money, not really even on real construction projects. It's not like he's improving national infrastructure. He is focusing on construction projects that better himself and his own sense of ego and the size of his flagpole.
There you go. Stephen, we knew Apple was a giant in terms of tax revenue. It's laid out for us today by Killian Woods. Apple's Irish operation accounts for 2/5 of its $43 billion global tax payments. You need to read this twice almost because the numbers are so significant.
They are. And again, you know, this is a recurring theme when we look at numbers in these stories, but you absolutely have to look beyond the headline too, right? Because you're right, the numbers are staggering and they are true and accurate, right? There's no question of their accuracy, but there is a story within the story, right? And this year is a different year to normal years.
Because of the $13 billion.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The famous Apple tax is finally in the books.
Yeah. Yeah. And when we talk about that 13, let's just put it in the context of a 17 million total, right? So ordinarily, this number is closer to 4 or 5 billion. Now, again, in context, this is still hugely important. And the article rightly calls out just how reliant Ireland has become now on companies like Apple. This is a well-known piece. But there's other parts to this. And I think one of the other standout figures for me was 5,575 people that are employed by Apple in Ireland. So a major employer, really critical in terms of those highly skilled jobs that it brings. And there are often, I think, two ways of looking at this, right? We can worry, with good reason, about this concentration of income that comes through these exceptional corporation tax payments. Or we can also take a moment and kind of say, look at the country we've become.
Absolutely.
Look at the country we have built, the type of companies we can attract, the amount of money that is now being raised, albeit perhaps not in some long-term sustainable way and with the risks of Trump and other kind of things. But ultimately, that money is now being raised by the government. And I think what it does is it shines a light on how important it is that this government makes really good decisions. Let's look at our last story. Our top story around doctors and nurses and the fact that we don't have enough of them. I mean, some of the most obvious questions that get raised here are, well, surely some of this money should be going towards investing in healthcare.
Yeah. Jonah, interesting as well, when we benchmark the figures against, you know, Apple's German and French offices.
That's funny. That's the bit that I thought was really interesting.
It shows really how Ireland is performing.
I think it's taking it out of that bit around tax, and it's just showing, you know, like who we are as a country, as you say, relative to the bigger players in Europe like Germany and France. They have recorded far more modest revenue and profit figures. Also, I thought was lovely too was this: the number of customers that are served from here is 120 countries, and was responsible for sales to more than 50 countries.
Yeah.
All being done from Apple in Ireland. A legitimate real business with the number of people that are employed. This is not a brass plate tax. This is real money being generated here.
Yeah.
And I think that's really significant.
Yeah, and just again to say it, the company, as Stephen pointed out, has 5,575 staff in Ireland, and they booked profits of 34 billion in 2020.
To be honest with you, I know it's for another story, but I'd be much happier if Tim Cook bought a castle down in Cork.
Now, Mike Ashley is in the news again. Why Mike Ashley's luxury retail empire is going cheap. This is a good piece by John Gapper. The sharp-elbowed billionaire, as he calls him, is remaking Frasers with acquisitions such as Harvey Nichols. But the stock market is very wary, Stephen.
Yeah, and again, this is a really interesting story because it's as much about the person who's doing the buying here as what's being sold, right? I mean, Harvey Nichols is a household name, but like an awful lot of, you know, these kind of large high street operations, it's coming under pressure, right? You know, more commerce going online, more shopping happening online. It does mean that there's a different onus and a different expectation now when you go into a high street store.
Well, effectively, it's coming out of a 40 million pre-packed administration, which is akin to receivership.
Yeah.
So it's more than just not doing great. It's in trouble.
But this is Ashley's, this is his modus operandi, right? I mean, he looks for
He buys bad stuff and makes it good.
Yeah.
In his eyes.
The distressed asset, right? And he does have this view that there is, that essentially this is about concentration, that there is space on the high street for a smaller number of these higher end luxury department stores, but there has to be fewer of them. And essentially that this is kind of what he's going after. But the question is, and I think this is where some of the nervousness comes from, is at what point will that occur and will shopping behavior change?
And on your point of that, to quote again, it's going to be a lot smaller. This is Ashley himself saying it's going to be a lot smaller pond, but some fish are going to be enormous. He remarked in 2019.
I think what was interesting about this story and the reflection is it centres very much on the character of Mike Ashley and how he operates. And it reminded me, we mentioned briefly there the bond market, and I was listening to Jim Power and Chris Johns riffing on their economics on the podcast the other day, and they said, somebody had said once, I want to come back as the bond markets. silent but really, really powerful. He said that the equity markets are always so much more fun because there's so much more story to them. There's so much more personality to them. And they're really much more accessible for people to be interested in. And I think this is a great case study in that. It's a case study on a man who has built an empire and how he does it and what motivates and drives him. And the family relationships even that he has in that. It's his son-in-law who is running the Fraser Group now. So all of those things make it a very interesting story about what's happening in there. And retail has always been the most interesting because it's where most of us are exposed to industry, whether you work in it or not. You're exposed to industry every time you shop.
And there was another quote about Mike Ashley that I liked that was in the Financial Times recently. I'm not Mary Poppins, but when you get into a fight with me, I'll come back at you. By God, he'll come back.
That's like the total opposite to Mary Poppins. But yeah. If there is the one word of warning here is that if you do have Harvey Nichols vouchers, if they were bought for after August 13th, they're not orders placed on gift cards purchased before August the 13th fall under the ownership structure preceding this transition, and they said that they wouldn't be honoured. So
that was up on the website.
Yeah, it is going to be appealed, but that is a word of warning for anyone who has those vouchers.
Yeah, it was interesting that the stats around vouchers, people not claiming them, like. Is it one in five or something are only used within a year of purchase? It's like there's an awful lot of dead money there.
We were just saying the only kind of gift vouchers that I would prefer these days is preloaded credit cards are the way to go, like Perks or some of those. You know, they're actually, you can use them anywhere and it does make things a lot easier and you're never at the susceptible.
Yeah, sorry, that was two-thirds of people received at least one gift card the previous Christmas, but only one in five people had not spent them within a year, an amount previously reported to be in the region of 70 million euros.
I think the ones that are harder to spend tend to be for, you know, restaurants.
Specialist places.
Yeah, or holidays, maybe hotels, just getting around to booking something and is that what you're going to do, you know?
Stephen, Irish homes are seriously unaffordable, says an international property think tank. The only consolation I got out of this story was that the issue around housing seems to be a global one rather than an Irish one.
Yeah, and I mean, again, this can definitely be filed under the unsurprising headlines section, I think, of our reviews, right? So this is Mark Keenan writing in the Irish Independent. Now, to be fair, Demographia International, who are the organisation who published this analysis each year, there is always a strong interest in seeing this because what it does is it provides that external context. Like, we're very familiar in Ireland with organizations telling us how much it costs from county to county and what the increases are quarter on quarter or month on month right across the island. And that's often our reference point. But like you say, it can be really valuable to understand that the grass isn't always greener. And while it's one thing to look at the really big ones here, maybe, you know, like Hong Kong or places like that, where maybe there are fewer Irish people emigrating to, we often hear about Australia, right? I mean, it's a very common country that we hear about Irish people emigrating to for a whole host of reasons and having an amazing experience there. And that will long continue and hopefully it does. But it's also a reminder that when you move there, it's not a case that one of the reasons that's happening is because housing is so much more affordable or so much cheaper there. Because several different Australian cities are cited here, with Sydney 13.8 times the median household income in terms of trying to buy a property. So,
and I think the benchmark they use is three times annual income or less has long been judged to be the universal indicator around affordability and housing.
But can I just add something? One of the things, the consolation for anyone in Ireland is, first of all, this references and use only data for Dublin. It doesn't use any of the other cities. And the good news is we are only seriously unaffordable because they offer the other alternatives you can be, which is worse, is severely unaffordable and impossibly unaffordable. So we are only seriously unaffordable, not severely and not impossibly.
Joan, when Spain gets too hot and America too turbulent just on housing, buyers look to Ireland, including Mark Zuckerberg, who's bought a nice little pad called Strancally Castle in West Waterford.
Well,
on the beautiful River Blackwater, near the village of Knockanore in West Waterford.
Well, first of all, to that point about climate and moving, because the temperature is better. Stephen just said the grass is not always greener. I think the fact that the grass is greener here is to our great advantage. It is not scorched earth. Now, we've had a rough summer for farmers, for sure, but the grass is still greener here. This is really interesting for me because I did what I'm calling my Southeast Odyssey last week, and I have been to Youghal just at the weekend and only 20 kilometres down the road from Strathcally Castle. And I said, darn it, I've just visited and he's ruined it for me already. But Youghal is I've never been before. And actually, it's a great little town. I mean, it needs a bit of money. But it seems it's coming their way because they're talking here about the number of people who are emigrating to Ireland, who are looking here as a better alternative to retirement. There was a small business I met called Brush and Barrel in Youghal last week, and it's a young German couple. Uh-huh. And they have chosen to set up a business and live in Youghal. And there's examples throughout this article of couples, individuals who are choosing to retire to Ireland. One of them cited, actually, a French couple have retired to Ireland for two reasons. Number one, climate. South of France was no longer anywhere they could possibly tolerate from a heat perspective. But the other was they didn't want to be on a, after the war, the invasion of Ukraine, they did not want to be on a landmass with mainland Europe. And they felt that there was some safety in being on an island.
Amazing.
That was interesting. There's so many different things going in our favour. The one thing I did think was going to be challenging with all of this is that the more people that are coming here, it says most US buyers are in their late 50s with high wealth. And so my concern there is they're going to come with an awful lot of money and they're going to end up pricing out a lot of local people from being able to buy homes. And that comes with its own challenges. And it is going to make things possibly moving from seriously unaffordable to severely unaffordable also.
Stephen, we're in the Goldilocks zone, which appears at one level, and that being not too hot and not too cold. The stats are bearing out, I suppose, a favourable win here for Ireland in terms of its attractiveness. Certainly at a European level because of misfortune elsewhere.
Yeah, and it does show too, I suppose, the growing role that the climate has in terms of where you choose to buy and live. And
yeah.
I think what's really interesting is that we have this kind of historical idea, particularly in our summers, of kind of saying, well, I've got to get out of Ireland, right? Because I want a bit of sunshine. And so sun holidays and that idea of getting away has been here for decades, right? This idea of wanting to get a little bit of sun. Now, actually, Ireland is becoming attractive because it's a place where you won't get as much sun. And I think if you told people 20 years ago that people were going to move to Ireland for the weather, they would have found it interesting.
Joan, just briefly, I'm a lecturer at the college I failed to get into. It's a great piece by Rachel O'Dwyer today, talking about being rejected from the NCAD and going her own route. I think this is encouraging for the Leaving Cert students yesterday. And now she's a lecturer in that college that rejected her all those years ago.
Yeah, they waitlisted her. And it is a lovely anecdote, a personal perspective on someone who didn't get their first choice. I thought it was interesting for me personally because my parents said to me at the time, no, you're not going to NCAD.
Okay.
You've got to go and get a proper job. And, you know, you can go back to art, which I have done later. So there is a path to everything.
All right. I'm going to leave that on a Jeremy Clarkson quote. Which says, don't worry if your A-level results are a bit disappointing. I got a C in two U's. And this evening I shall sit in my agreeable garden, drinking beer from my own brewery and eating food from my own farm, prepared by my very own chef.
And for the young, they should know that U means ungraded, because, of course, that's an old marking system.
There you go. Thanks, Stephen. Thank you, Joan. Enjoy your weekend.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr. Sponsored by Bank of Ireland. Saturday morning at 8. News Talk. Conversation that counts.